This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
The night sky for May 2016. As we'll see, we have two real highlights this month, so keep listening. Well, as night falls during May, over towards the southwest, we'll see Leo, below which, of course, is the brightest object in the sky at the time, Jupiter, down to the lower left of Regulus, Alpha Leonis. Over then, towards the south, is a fairly blank region of sky. It contains the constellation of Virgo, above which is Coma Berenices. And the only really bright star, not that far above the horizon, is Spica in Virgo. But between Virgo and the tail of Leo is a wonderful area of the sky called the Realm of the Galaxies. It's a wonderful place to observe with perhaps a 6-inch telescope on a dark sky when there's no moon. But one will see one bright star slightly to the east of south. That is Arcturus in the constellation of Bootes. And just to the left, actually, is a nice little circlet of stars called Corona Borealis, the Northern Crown. Then you might pick up Hercules on the way towards the second bright star you'll see towards the east with his Vega in Lyra. Again, with binoculars or a small telescope, if you look at what's called the keystone of Hercules, the four brightest stars, and you go up two-thirds of the way on the right-hand side, hopefully you'll spot a wonderful globular cluster called M13. And then finally, beyond Lyra, we begin to see Deneb, the brightest star in Cygnus the Swan. And perhaps just on the horizon a little bit later, we see Altair. And Altair, Vega, and Deneb form what we call the summer triangle. So perhaps this month we're heading towards the summer. Well, let's have a look at the planets first. Jupiter is now a little bit past its best, but it's still high in the south at nightfall. Its brightness falls slightly from magnitudes minus 2.3 to minus 2.1, whilst the angular size drops from 41 to 37 arc seconds. It spends a month below the hindquarters of Leo, halting its retrograde motion westwards across the sky on May the 9th. It sets around 4 a.m. as May begins, but by 2 a.m. by month's end. And of course, with a small telescope, one should easily be able to see the equatorial bands in the atmosphere, sometimes the great red spot, and in the highlights section of the night sky page, just put in Jodrell Bank night sky, I actually list the times when I think it's dark, when the red spot will be facing the Earth. And you also, of course, might see any of up to four of the Galilean moons as they weave their way around it. Saturn is rising in the late evening, in fact about 30 minutes after Mars at the beginning of May. We're getting closer, so its brightness increases slightly from plus 0.2 to 0.0 magnitudes. At the same time, the angular size grows to 18.4 arc seconds. Saturn's rings are tilted by 26 degrees from the line of sight, almost as open as they ever get, and span some 42 arc seconds across. It's moving towards opposition on the night of June the 2nd. Saturn forms a triangle with Mars and Antares throughout the month, separated from Mars by 8 degrees as May begins, and by 15 degrees as month's end. As Saturn moves very slowly across the heavens, it stays a near constant distance up and to the left of Antares in Scorpius. Well, the top highlight this month is the transit of Mercury on May the 9th, but otherwise it'll be too dim and low above the horizon to see. Now Mars, well, that's our second highlight of the month. It reaches its closest point to the Earth on May the 29th, and that's over the last 11 years. Its angular size then will be 18.6 arc seconds. It actually begins May with an angular size of 16 arc seconds with a magnitude of minus 1.5, but then it brightens until it reaches a peak magnitude of minus 2.1 at the end of the month, so equaling the magnitude of Jupiter for a few days. Mars is in retrograde motion westwards across the sky. It's lying low in Scorpius, beginning the month 5 degrees north of Antares and passing between Beta and Delta Scorpii on the 19th as it moves towards Libra. Now Venus is heading towards superior conjunction with the Sun, and that means on the far side, and that'll be on June the 2nd, so it's not actually visible during May. Well, what about the highlights? Well, May the 9th, the transit of Mercury across the face of the Sun. We will, if clear in the UK, be able to witness the complete passage of Mercury's disk across the Sun's face. The transit begins soon after 11 hours UT, the midpoint at about 1458 UT, and Mercury leaves the Sun's disk at 1842 UT, a total time of about 7.5 hours. This is Mercury's first transit since 2006, and I was lucky enough to see it then, and the next will occur on November the 11th, 2019, but in fact will not be so easily visible from the UK. These three are three of the 13 or 14 transits of Mercury that occur each century. Mercury's black disk will appear only 10 arc seconds across, so binoculars or a telescope will be needed to observe the transit. If direct viewing is to be made, suitable solar filters must be placed in front of the objectives, the two of the binoculars, or the single one of the telescope. And filters made of Bada solar film are probably best. One must, of course, be very, very careful whenever observing the Sun. Alternatively, an image of the Sun can be projected onto a white card using a small telescope or half a binocular. A metal eyepiece is really needed to prevent heat damage, and it's probably best to limit the aperture of a telescope to about 1 inch across using a cardboard mask. At first glance, Mercury's disk might at just 1/200th that of the Sun appear like a sunspot, but it'll be precisely round, be even darker than a sunspot, and will lack a grey penumbra. And, of course, it'll be moving across the Sun's disk. Hopefully, if it's clear, it'll be interesting to watch the ingress and exit of Mercury's disk, taking about 3 minutes and 12 seconds to do so. We'll keep our fingers crossed, shall we? So the second highlight is from around May the 22nd to June the 8th, Mars at its best for 11 years. Mars reaches opposition, that is when the Earth lies between the Sun and Mars, and will it be approximately due south at midnight UT, or 1 a.m. BST, and that's on the 22nd of May, so it'll be visible for most of the hours of darkness. However, it'll actually be closest to Earth, and so have its greatest angular size of 18.6 arc seconds some 8 days later, on the 29th, 30th of May. The angular size at closest approach varies due to the ellipticity of the orbit of Mars, and to a far lesser extent to that of the Earth, will actually reach 26 arc seconds during the year 25,695 AD. At closest approach in 2003, Mars reached an angular size of 25.1 arc seconds, its largest angular diameter for about 60,000 years. In July 2018, it will reach 24.2 arc seconds, which is quite good. But the trouble is, for both this opposition and that in 2018, Mars is and will be very low in the ecliptic, and hence at a low elevation as seen from the UK. So the atmosphere will limit our views of the red, actually, I'd say salmon pink, planet. Happily, it'll be higher in the sky at the opposition of 2020. You can find out what aspect of Mars should be visible any time using an application done by Sky and Telescope. You can find it details on the Night Sky page. It's http://is.gb/Mars Profiler. So I've looked at that, and you can see when the Syrtis Major might be facing you and other of the more obvious aspects of Mars. I've listed the times during May when Jupiter's great red spot will be facing the Earth. Obviously, there are rather fewer this month because there's not so much darkness. On May the 5th and the 6th, before dawn, we have a chance of seeing the Eta Aquarii meteor shower. It's actually one of the finest meteor showers that can be seen from the southern hemisphere, but I'm afraid it's rather low in the sky for us. It may be glimpsed, the meteors that is, in the pre-dawn sky in the southeast some 90 minutes before dawn. Quite pleasingly, this year the peak corresponds to new moon, so there'll be no moonlight to hinder our view. Well, on May the 7th, there's a nice grouping of Saturn, Mars and Antares just looking to the south-southwest in the hours before sunrise. Saturn is above and Mars to the upper right, close to Antares in Scorpius. Another nice thing to look for on the 7th, after sunset, if it's clear and if you've got a good low horizon in the west-northwest, you may be able to spot a very thin waxing crescent moon, just 1% illuminated. You may well need to use binoculars, but please do not use them until the sun has set. And a nice thing that we can sometimes see with such a thin crescent is what is called earthshine, with the other part of the moon's surface illuminated by light reflected from the earth. And on the Night Sky website, I've actually put a picture of earthshine that I took at the Isle of Wight Star Party in 2012 with a telescope that's particularly suitable for the job, and it's actually one of my best ever photographs and did actually win an award last year. So that's May the 7th after sunset. Finally, I usually put an interesting object on the moon to observe, and on the 14th and 27th, the Terminator is quite close to what's called the Hyginus Rill. For some time, a debate raged as to whether the craters on the moon were caused by impacts or volcanic activity. We now know that virtually all were caused by impact. But it's thought that the Hyginus crater that lies at the centre of the Hyginus Rill may well be volcanic in origin. It's an 11-kilometre-wide rimless pit, in contrast, of course, to craters which have raised rims. And its close association with the rill of the same name associates it with internal lunar events. It can quite easily be seen to be surrounded by dark material. It's thought that came from an explosive release of dust and gas, which created a vacant space below, so the overlying surface collapsed, so forming the crater.
Okay, thanks for that, Ian. And for our listeners below the equator, here's our Southern Hemisphere night sky with Haritina Mogasani.
Clear skies from Space Place at Carter Observatory in Aotearoa, New Zealand. My name is Haritina Mogoshanu, and tonight I am your storyteller from the Southern Hemisphere. In Maori, tahi, rua, toru means one, two, three. Three bright planets and the brightest stars share the evening sky this May, and you can see them in three ways when you look at the sky: with the naked eye, with a pair of binoculars, and with a telescope. I love each of these methods. They are each in their way very special, and each add a layer of depth to the previous one, which is why I always recommend to people to never buy a telescope unless they have got naked eye stargazing or binocular observing sorted. Otherwise, it would be too frustrating to look for all these deep sky objects. Besides, wouldn't you want to know where you are looking? Even with a go-to telescope, which is what most modern telescopes are, they just find their way across the sky and would not feel that much fun not to know where I'm pointing the lens. Not to mention that any go-to telescope needs to be polar aligned. That is a part making the mount of the telescope would have to be aligned with Earth's axis of rotation in order for the go-to function to work. So what can we see with the naked eye in May? Soon after sunset, circumpolar Atutahi Canopus, the second brightest star, is southwest of the point directly above you overhead. Tahi means one in Maori, suggesting that Atutahi is the chief of the stars and visible all night long. Takurua Sirius, the brightest star, appears northwest of the zenith. Rua means two in Maori, and Takurua is one of the two wives of Ra, the sun. Below Takurua are bluish Puanga, or Raijo, and reddish Putara, or Betelgeuse, the brightest stars in Orion. Between them is a vertical line made of three stars, Tau Toru. Toru means three in Maori, and it's the name given to Orion's belt. The three planets in the sky are, in order of appearance, Jupiter, Mars, and Saturn. Golden Jupiter appears in the north. It's the brightest starlight object in May and lights up the night until the early hours of the morning, the wee hours, as they say here in New Zealand. Orange Mars comes up in the east just after sunset. It will be at opposition on 22nd, which also means that Mars will be very bright. The term opposition can be a little confusing, but what opposition actually relates to? It's the way we see Mars from Earth, as it sits directly opposite to the Sun, with the Earth between them. In May 2016, Mars rises in the east just as the Sun sets in the west. Then, after staying up in the sky the entire night, Mars sets in the west just as the Sun rises in the east. Since Mars and the Sun appear on opposite sides of the sky, we say that Mars is in opposition. Also, if Earth and Mars followed perfectly circular orbits, opposition would be as close as the two planets could get. But their orbits are neither circular nor coplanar, coplanar meaning in the same plane. So the closest approach between Mars and Earth in almost 60,000 years occurred during 2003, which I vividly remember for two reasons. One was that I got the chance to draw Mars through a telescope for an entire week during one of our famous astro camps and felt a bit like a late Schiaparelli observing all the dark and light features on it, including having my very first attempt at drawing Syrtis Major. The second reason was that ever since 2003 I witnessed an impressive amount of spam mail letting people know that Mars will be seen in the sky as big as the full moon. Remember that email? It is known as the Mars hoax, and even though the amount of spam diminished dramatically since then, there is the occasional blip which I hope not to see again, as I will probably be tempted to unfriend the person who sent it. What can each of us do to prevent things like this from happening? One of the things I do is outreach. Astro camps are amazing opportunities to do outreach. I remember my first one as it was yesterday. We went for an entire week in this very dark location near Tergovište in 2003. We had many visitors who were curious to see what we were doing, and we were happy to see them, even when they drove with the headlights on right in the middle of our observing party. Outreach is extremely important in astronomy and space science. Probably my favorite sound of all sounds is when I hear the wow that comes after people seeing Saturn. It's as if they teleport into another world, and the most frequent comment is how Saturn looks so much like Saturn. I've been continuously doing outreach since then, since those magical nights at the 2003 Astro Camp, to bringing together a team from NASA and students and teachers from New Zealand in 2015 in an expedition that looked for extreme life on Earth called Space Rebound. Share your passion for stars, even if you think you only know a tiny thing about them. I will always remember everyone who heard for the first time that we are made of stars, and that because of it, everything we dream about might be just possible. Stars and space are best hooks I have ever encountered to motivate people to be curious about who they are, what is life, if there are others out there, and what is the future of humankind. And I believe that the last one is the most beautiful question of all because of the legacy that it leaves. I would love to think that humankind will survive past the 4.5 billion years left from our sun to burn, and hope that it might actually be possible to do so. Imagine that this is the one thing that could unite people in realizing how unique we are, that extinction is forever, and that we only have one home right now, called the Pale Blue Dot. Our small astrocamp reached a good amount of people. On a personal level, who would have known that little me who was drawing a distant Mars through the telescope would end up one day doing Mars analog missions at the Mars Desert Research Station, MDRS, in Utah, and linked to students and teachers in New Zealand, thanks to Carter Observatory Space Place acting as mission control. Space Place at Carter was stellar, for the lack of a better word, in helping with the outreach effort and served as mission control. From there, school groups could link with us on Mars and communicate live. We did not use the time delay necessary when talking with the real Mars. But the students had the chance to ask all the wacky questions that kids can ask about space exploration, and also all the amazingly serious and scientific questions we all know they come up with. Space Place at Carter also supplemented our Mars theme with shows and talks. Analog sites in Utah were chosen that looked like the real Mars and with similarities in New Zealand, so that the students were able to replicate the experiment almost in their backyard. Having the Space Place at Carter Observatory backing up this effort was very rewarding. As a consequence, Mars was intensely studied in the classroom because of the combined outreach effort. It took a bit of engineering to bring it all together, just like in The Martian, but we made it through whilst keeping everyone happy. The expertise we gained during the missions helped to bring science to the classroom by using space as a hook via the observatory. And who would have thought that there was going to come another day when another one of my outreach missions would have gone global during the World Space Week 2013, when we broadcast from MDRS globally, and the stones we collected from around the world mixed with a real meteorite from Mars were immortalized in beautiful Swarovski crystals, out of which three were sent to the International Space Station with astronaut Samantha Cristoforetti. I did not even dream about all these things, but it all happened to me because I love talking about the stars, and because people love hearing about the stars. They do. And they love hearing that they are made from the stars. So anyway, back to what really happens in the sky. During opposition, Earth passes between Mars and the Sun. This occurs only every 26 months because Earth makes two trips around the Sun in about the same amount of time that Mars takes to make one trip. Sometimes, like now, we will be on the same side of the Sun as Mars at opposition. Some other time, we will be on the opposite side. Go figure. And when Mars is on the opposite of opposition, it will actually be hidden behind the Sun as it comes between us and Mars, which is the time when communications with Mars are avoided, as there is a lot of interference from the Sun. As the sky darkens, Saturn appears below Mars. Mercury is very close to the Sun in May, so not visible from anywhere in the world with one exception. This is why I will only just mention a spectacular event which enchants the clear skies viewers from everywhere else but East Asia, Japan, Indonesia, Australia, and New Zealand. On Monday, 9th of May 2016, starting at 11:15 p.m. New Zealand Standard Time, most of the world will be able to see the planet Mercury transiting across the disk of the Sun. From Earth, we can only see Mercury and Venus transiting the Sun, as these two planets are in between Earth and the Sun. There are about 13 to 14 transits of Mercury in a century, and they all occur within a few days from May the 8th and November the 10th. We will not be able to see this one for the simple reasons that it happens during our nighttime. We can, however, still watch it online from New Zealand, as several different webcasts will cover the transit. The event will last for 7 hours, so we have time for a nap too. Back again to things we can see in the sky. Crookes, the Southern Cross, is southeast of the zenith, to the right of the pointers. Alpha and Beta Centauri. Zenith refers to an imaginary point directly above a particular location on the imaginary celestial sphere. Orange Antares, right of Mars, marks the body of Scorpius, the scorpion. Antares means rival to Mars in Greek, for the planet and star are often similar in color and brightness, but not at this time of the year. The Milky Way, our edgewise view of the galaxy, is brightest in the southeast towards Scorpius and Sagittarius, where its center lies, and it can be traced up the sky past the Pointers and Crookes, fading towards Sirius. Its nearby outer edge is by Orion, where the Milky Way is faintest. The clouds of Magellan, Large Magellanic Cloud and Small Magellanic Cloud, are two small galaxies midway down the southern sky, easily seen by eye on a dark moonless night. If you use your peripheral vision, which means don't try to stare directly at them, using the edge of your vision out of the corner of your eye will reveal more detail. It's a trick we use in stargazing and has to do with how our eyes are constructed. Night vision is mostly based on our rod cells, the ones responsible with detecting movement, which is also something we see very well with the edge of our vision. Once you've mastered the naked eye observing, it's time to try the next level, binoculars. What can we see with a pair of binoculars? Binoculars come in many shapes and forms. A great size for stargazing is 7x50 or 10x50. The first number is a measure of power. It means how much these binoculars magnify. In this case, the 7 and the 10. The second number is the diameter of the objective, the big lenses at the front in millimeters. In this case, the 50. I love binoculars. They are my favorite aid to observing the night sky because they are light. You can take them easily with you on trips. They don't really require assembly and disassembly. No polar alignment. And visually are better than telescopes. With a tripod attached, they are truly magnificent. Comets and some open star clusters are sometimes better observed with binoculars. We have two eyes, so binocular views are more spectacular in many regards than telescopic, because our brains interpret what we see. Binoculars give depth of view as they engage both eyes in the process. There are few great objects that you could admire in binoculars, for instance Jupiter and its four moons. Also, on the ecliptic M44, the Precepi in Cancer, known as the Beehive, the open cluster swarms with stars. It is as far as 577 light-years and estimated 730 million years old, with an average magnitude of 3.5. Also in Cancer, M37, it's another open cluster, one of the oldest known, almost 3.2 billion years. Another good target for binoculars is Leo, marked by the bright Jupiter. Jupiter is 750 million kilometers away, so it is always worth a look. Its four big Galilean moons look like faint stars near the planet. One or two can be seen in binoculars. All four are easily seen in any telescope magnifying 20 or more. Sometimes one or more of the moons will be invisible as they pass in front of or behind Jupiter. The moon is another very good binocular object and it will be near Jupiter on the 15th of May. Close to the area south of the triangle that marks Leo's hips, M65, M66 and NGC 3628, which will be visible depending on the size of your binoculars, are also good objects. They are also known as the Leo Trio. Also in Leo, M105 is an elliptical galaxy. Last but not least, M96, another galaxy in Leo, lies at about 35 million light years away. At the beginning of May, Jupiter sets around 2 a.m., reducing to around midnight by month's end, and so you might want to look at these objects in Leo in the first part of the night. If everything else fails, simply take your binoculars and swipe the Milky Way from one edge to the other. You might not figure out exactly which object you were looking at, but you would definitely find amazing sights, especially in the region close to Carina. You will find these open clusters IC2602, NGC314, NGC353, NGC2516. As I said, they're all in Carina and then in Crookes NGC 4755, which is another open cluster, NGC 2451 in Puppis, and IC 2391 in Vela. Lower down, Omega Centauri is a globular cluster in Centaurus, and in Scorpius there are the Butterfly Cluster, M7 Open Cluster, and NGC 6231 Open Cluster. Saturn is a great sight even with a pair of binoculars, and this time its rings are near maximum tilt. It is 1.360 million kilometers away. Titan, its biggest moon, orbits 4 ring diameters from the planet. You might also be able to see Titan in binoculars. One of my Bibles in terms of what to see in the night sky, it's Philips' Night Sky Atlas by Robin Schedule and with maps by Will Tyrion. And every time someone asks me what telescope to buy, and I ask them back if they do have a pair of binoculars, if the answer is no, then I always say don't buy a telescope if you have not looked at the sky with binoculars. Even if you only use them to locate objects that are too faint for the naked eye or hidden by light pollution. Some of the best views of the largest star clusters, bright nebulae, and comets are best seen in binoculars. My first binocular was called Li. That is because, according to the Chinese wisdom, a road of 1,000 li starts with the first step. I used to be very scared of the dark, but I never felt small, insignificant, and vulnerable when I saw the vastness of the universe. I never felt lost among a myriad of stars. I have always been basking in starlight, and I've always been curious to know why it feels so good. I believe that by looking at the stars, we can find out who we were, who we are, and most importantly, who we will become. This concludes our podcast for May 2016 at Space Place at Qatar Observatory. As the Maori say, E fitia nana fetu rangi, the stars are shining in the sky, kotakoto akene ko papatu anuku, whilst Mother Earth lays beneath. May you enjoy clear and dark skies so that you can see the stars, and remember that we are made of the same stardust as they are. Kia kaha, and clear skies from the space place at Carter Observatory in Aotearoa, New Zealand.